This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company. One Man's Family, brought to you by Tenderleaf Tea. One Man's Family is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildering offspring. Tonight we present Chapter 13, Book 40, entitled The Last of 1941. This is the season of hospitality, and this year, more than ever before, Tenderleaf Tea Balls are adding to the enjoyment, making more friends every day. Yes, in the short time they've been available, Tenderleaf Tea Balls have become the largest-selling tea balls in America. First choice, because they really are such a vast improvement. They're made of special filter paper, which has the great advantage of being entirely tasteless. Your tea is filtered as it's made, filling your cup with amber delight, unclouded, without a speck in it, and absolutely free from any foreign taste. So you enjoy only the finer flavor of the choice tea leaves, small, young, and delicate, the top leaves of the tea plant. Stock up with these better tea balls for a festive New Year. Your grocer has them in boxes of 8, 20, 50, and 100. Each tea ball kept scrupulously clean in an envelope all its own. Ask for Tenderleaf brand tea balls, the largest selling tea balls in America. It's a bitter, rain-drenched night out on the edge of the Pacific in the area known as Sea Cliff, where the Barber House stands on a brink looking directly across an expanse of open water to the Marin Hills, and with a Golden Gate visible just to the right. That is, ordinarily visible. But on this last day of the year 1941, there's too much weather boiling and brewing even to see one's hand before his face, and no indifferent weather either. On this afternoon of New Year's Eve, the rain came down angrily, bucket on bucket, and the minute it let up along about dusk, a thick, soupy fog closed in, but only for an hour, because hardly had the ocean edge become neatly blanketed in when a sharp wind blew in off the Pacific and whisked the fog away, uprooting eucalyptus trees and smashing windows. In one breath, it blew away the fog, and in the next, it blew in bigger and better rain clouds, so that now at 10 o'clock at night, the whole area is splashing and sloshing like a sluice box. And within the big, comfortable living room of the Barbers, the lights turned low, and before a glowing fire flickering on the walls and glinting the woodwork, are gathered all the family except the very young generation. All here together to receive the new year at midnight.
For goodness sake, Jack, close that window.
Yeah, okay.
I feel wet to the skin just hearing it.
Oh, boy, what a night out. Not fit for man nor beastie.
Yes, a wicked ending to a wicked year.
I say, Father Barber, how poetic. 1941 is dying as it has lived, violently.
Yes, undoubtedly 41 will go down in the annals of history as a cruel, dark year.
It'll be very interesting to read 100 years hence just what sort of signpost this past year is.
What do you mean by that, Paul?
Well, will 41 be called the darkest year, the climax of many unsettled years? Or will historians refer to it as the curtain raiser on a new dark age?
Oh, golly, Paul, do you think it might be?
No, Betty, as a matter of fact, I don't. But I do know whether the world gets well or whether it sinks into a dark abyss of ugliness and cruelty and famine and pestilence depends upon whether the United States and England and their allies win this conflict.
Yeah, I believe that. And I believe something else, too. I believe a lot of us have got to get into a different frame of mind about this thing. I mean, there's too many of us standing on the brink, confused and appalled and wondering whether to turn back or plunge in. I'm saying it badly.
No, go on. You're doing fine.
But what I'm trying to say is that war's a terrible thing for God-fearing and peace-loving people like us, and it's a pretty violent shock for some of us to find ourselves in it. And what those people who are shocked have got to remember and keep remembering is that the war we're in now isn't a drop in the bucket to what the horrors and terrors would be if we were defeated.
You make it sound like a bad dream, Cliff.
That's just it. It's not a dream. It's stuff that's hanging over our heads. Right out here a few miles from our own back door, Japanese submarines have been prowling this past week.
Exactly.
People would just get it through their heads that it's true, it's happened. Boy, am I making a speech for myself.
And a very potent one, too, I think.
Right.
But could I ask a question?
It's an open meeting.
Well, but don't you think that the main trouble is that most people want to get in and do something, but they don't know what to do?
Well, practically every newspaper in the country has stories every day what citizens can do in their own communities to help civilian defense.
Yes, I suppose so.
You don't agree, Teddy?
Oh, sure, I know people have got to build up civilian defenses, but... Well, I just have the feeling that a lot of people are running around in circles, doing a lot of things that aren't necessary and are interfering with the real defense of the country just because it's the smart thing to do right now.
Yes, Teddy, that's true. There are always people like that on any occasion.
Oh, sure. But the lame brains and nitwits are in the minority by a heck of a lot. Sensible people are volunteering their services and then sitting back waiting until they're needed. Hazel, tell them what you're doing down the peninsula.
Cliff, I wasn't going to mention that.
Why the heck not? It's important, isn't it?
I think it is.
Huh? What are you talking about?
Well, I don't know whether you realize it or not, but the mountains all along the Pacific coastline are literally teeming with lookout stations.
They are?
Well, yes. Almost every prominent point that has a good view out towards the ocean has a station. A 24-hour watch is maintained by trained civilian volunteers. And every airplane that passes within sight or hearing is checked off and reported to a central office, where more volunteers keep records of all planes.
And you're doing that, Hazel?
4 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Oh, I think that's terrific, Hazel. Couldn't I do something like that?
Well, they try to get people who live in the neighborhood, Teddy, so that they don't have to travel great distances. But they do need volunteers in many districts. Why, in some places, the people are having to watch for 8 to 10 hour stretches every day because they have so few volunteers.
Yeah, and if you think giving time and energy like that's being done because it's smart to do...
Oh, no, I didn't mean that at all. Well, it's just that I've been kind of confused. I want to help, but I don't want to just be spending my time.
Getting back to what Cliff was saying, I think the most important aid we can give, aside from putting all we can scrape together in defense stamps and bonds, which we take for granted... is to become thoroughly conversant with American ideals, with the great cause for which we're waging war, and to believe in it, to eat it and sleep it and keep it always before us. War is bad, but the dictator ideology is impossible. If we make that a personal slogan, and if every other citizen will keep that thought, the American civilian population is doing its greatest good for an assurance of victory.
War is bad, but the dictator ideology is impossible. That's our thought for this war.
Yeah. Didn't somebody once say, it's better to be fighting to the death in a free man's tattered rags than kissing a master's hand dressed in slavey silks and satins?
Well, if no one ever did, he should have. Yeah.
And more than that, I...
Just a minute, Teddy, huh?
Hmm?
Mom, you've been trying to get a word in edgeways the last 5 minutes. Teddy will give you the floor now, I'm sure.
Oh, sure, Mother Barbara.
Well, I just want to say that's enough about the war tonight.
Huh?
Yes, this is New Year's Eve. For the few minutes that remain in this old year, let's make this more of a family party, not so much a sober-sided convention.
Oh, yes, let's. We don't talk about anything else anymore.
Which is not surprising, inasmuch as our hearts and our minds are full of this trouble.
Nevertheless, I agree with Mother and Betty. No more talk of war tonight. Everyone agreed, say aye.
All opposed?
Yes.
And just to get your minds on something else, I'm going out now and wheel in the tea wagon.
Mom, I thought you weren't going to bring out the food until 11.
Well, it's only half an hour or so, and that's the only way I'm going to get your father's mind off the war. Getting to thinking about his stomach. So, Teddy, will you help me?
Mm-hmm, I should say I will.
Well, come along, then.
How about me, Mother?
Sure, and me.
No, Teddy and I have everything set out. It'll only take us a few minutes.
Teddy's got to be Mom's right-hand man around the house, hasn't he?
Yes, I don't think they could be closer if they were mother and daughter.
And how jolly for both of them.
Yes. Teddy's getting a rounded home life that I could never have given her alone. You know, when I look back on my unmitigated audacity in adopting Teddy and thinking I could give her all she needed, I'm amazed at myself.
Well, how wonderful for Teddy that you did adopt her, though.
Listen, didn't I hear something?
Only the wind and the rain, Betty.
Go open the window a minute. Do you mind, darling?
Sure, why not?
Where did you think you heard, Betty? I don't know.
Here she goes up.
Why, Betty, you couldn't possibly hear any sound out in that Nelson.
Sure, and if you had planes in mind, Betty, they've got more sense than to be out in a night like this.
Right, even if there were any.
Okay, Jack. Shut the window.
Okay.
Ooh, did you get that breath of cold air that swept into the room?
Boy, you'd think 10,000 red Indians were whooping and hollering out there from the sound of things. Sure. Those are the rain devils who come out only at night.
Huh? Rain devils?
Sure. They have black wings like a bat's wings, only they're like wet silk to the touch. They have faces like monkeys with spike horns, and they come out on stormy nights and flap against the windows and make shadows on your walls and yell and whistle down your chimney. Oh, an infidel, huh?
An infidel?
You're doggone right. Anybody who doesn't believe in my rain devils is an infidel and is liable to be cut off without an inheritance tax to pay.
All right, everybody. Gangway for a lady with a tea table.
We sit right in here beside my chair, Teddy.
Woo-wee, will you look what's coming? Boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
Mom, a whole new unused cold turkey.
Oh, yeah.
But it is a new turkey. Look, he hasn't been touched by a carving knife anyplace.
Of course not. I roasted him this morning. I thought cold turkey would be a nice change tonight.
Mom, you're a jewel of great pride.
Oh, am I indeed?
Yes. And is that a new bread, Fanny?
It certainly is.
Yes. Make me a turkey sandwich, Fanny. A turkey sandwich and a glass of that ice-cold milk.
My father, how can you like milk so much when you're so set against the source of supply, the cow?
I refuse to admit to myself that there's any connection. And it's very easy to do, because it seems most unlikely that anything so delicious as milk could possibly come from anything so stupid as a bovine.
Oh, I resent that.
Yes, so do I, Father.
Huh?
Just because you've never really got close to a cow, Dad.
Yeah, which is exactly to my liking.
Well, just the same, though, a Guernsey cow is a gentle, friendly, and cooperative animal. I'm establishing some lifelong friendships down on the dairy ranch.
I've got tea poured for everyone. Help yourself.
Mmm, such delicious things to eat, Mother Barber.
Doggone right. Let the wind blow and the rain come down. The three F's to protect us, who cares?
What are the three F's?
Fire, family, and food. The essence of domestic tranquility.
Well, not bad. Not bad at all.
Oh, by the way, Paul, how's your arm? See, you've got it out of splint.
Yeah, that's right. Just hanging in a sling around my neck now.
Oh, then that means it's getting back to normal, huh?
It will be if his elbow doesn't go back stiff.
What's that?
Teddy.
I don't see why you try to keep it a secret. That's what the doctor told you.
But your elbow will be stiff, Paul?
Oh, I'm exercising it and have it massaged 2 or 3 times a week.
And besides that, they're using lights on it.
You have no business telling, Teddy.
Well, I'm worried about it.
Yes, now everyone will be worried about it.
But, Paul, what happened?
Well, it seems that sometimes a stiff arm results from a break at the elbow, in spite of everything.
Doggone, fella. Is it definite?
Oh, of course not. We'll know for a couple of months.
Paul, you should have told us.
Now, look, we were going to keep away from gloomy forebodings tonight. Has everybody forgotten that?
Exactly. Paul, do you remember the story you told us a number of years ago about an experience you had the Christmas you spent in France in World War I?
Hey, yeah, Paul, tell it. Betty's never heard it. It's swell.
I don't know what story you're talking about.
Oh, sure you do. About the Christmas stick candy your mess sergeant gave away.
It wasn't stick candy. It was candy canes.
Okay, candy canes. That's the one you mean, isn't it, Nicky?
Matter of fact, it wasn't. The one I had in mind had to do with popcorn balls.
Oh, sure, Paul. Tell that one. Why don't you tell them both? I haven't heard either one.
Go on, Paul. Gee.
Oh.
Oh, please, Paul.
Well, stories of the First World War are rather passe today, I'm afraid. You know, it makes me feel a little strange and cold inside when I remember that many of the men fighting this war weren't even born when I was over there fighting in the last one.
Now who's getting serious, Paul?
All right, the story of the peppermint stick candy.
Oh, sure, it wasn't candy canes at all.
Well, this didn't happen exactly at Christmas time, but it did happen that our supply sergeant was very much the ladies' man. As you know, there was a shortage of sugar in the war area. Well, it got around that all the companies in our sector, with the exception of ours, had received an issue of peppermint stick candy. We checked up and found our chic supply sergeant had held out on us and was using the stick, Andy, to win the feminine hearts of the French nation.
Oh, boy, were those the days. Now you can't get a girl to walk across the street with you for less than a 5-pound box of candy. And, boy, it better hadn't be peppermint.
What did you ever do to the supply sergeant, Paul?
Yeah, you never told us to pay you off.
Well, that we won't talk about.
Oh. Not meant for polite ears, huh?
Now tell the one about the popcorn balls.
Yeah, no fair.
Huh?
Here you people are, munching away on all the good things, 13 to the dozen, and my tea is cooling, and my sandwich is unmunched on.
Oh, go on. Tell them the popcorn one, and then you can eat while Dad talks.
Huh?
Well, sure, Dad. You were going to tell us about one of the early barbers, don't you remember?
Who? One of the early barbers, eh?
Sure.
Was I indeed?
Yeah, some of those wonderful Aboriginal barbers. Along about the time the family was coming down out of the tree.
The barbers spring from wonderful stock. Wonderful stock. A family tree with many and varied branches.
Well, while you're deciding which branch to tell us about, Paul, you give us the popcorn story.
Well, let's see. How does it begin?
Well, how about starting... Did I ever tell you about the time our company cook tried to make popcorn balls for us on Christmas in France?
That's an excellent start.
Yeah, and then we say, we don't think you ever did, Paul. Go on, tell it.
Yeah, and then you tell us in simple, direct English.
Hey, you folks keep still or he won't tell it. Sure. You're talking right out of the mood.
Go ahead, Paul. We'll keep still.
All right. But, Betty, this is especially for you because everyone else has heard it.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, some good-hearted woman back home sent the captain 10 pounds of popcorn for Christmas. Annie turned it over to the cook and ordered popcorn balls for the entire company. Our cook was a Frenchman, and I don't suppose he'd ever heard of such a thing. Popcorn itself was a novelty to him, let alone all the complication of popcorn balls. Anyway, somebody told him to make a syrup and pour over the corn. But it wouldn't stick together. Cook was out of sympathy with the whole business, a silly, infantile idea that might be expected from across the Atlantic. But if the captain wanted popcorn balls, Frenchie wasn't anyone to say he shouldn't have them, so he slipped into the adjutant's tent and got a bottle of glue and poured it on top.
Oh, golly.
And did we have popcorn balls?
Paul, you didn't eat them.
Every morsel. But before the night was over, the entire company was standing in line before our hospital unit, holding its individual and collective stomach. Between the stomach pump and the castor oil bottle, our medical staff did yeoman service that night.
And what happened to the French cook?
Oh, you wouldn't really like to know, I'm sure of it.
You know, from all the hints you throw out, you must have belonged to a rough-and-tumble outfit.
War is a rough-and-tumble business. And a soldier's sense of humor gets pretty fundamental and violent at times. Hey, Mom, this is some of your better fruitcake, eh?
Thank you, Paul. That's some I made last year.
Oh, 1940 vintage, eh?
I thought the flavor was awfully well blended to be this year's cake. Yes, and the older it is, the darker the color and the finer the texture.
Yes, Teddy, would you hand me another piece?
Okay, and how about pouring you some more milk?
If you please.
Okay.
Okay, Dad, all eyes are focused on you.
Huh?
It's now your turn to perform. Which one of the many ancestors of the Barber clan are you going to expose for us?
I wonder if I ever told you about my father's uncle on his father's side. A crotchety old gentleman named Brutus Barber.
Dad, it's not true.
Huh?
Well, there couldn't have been a barber named Brutus.
Yes, Brutus Barber. One of your own uncles, 3 times removed.
And each time he came back?
Very, very funny.
What's that? Yeah.
I'm the one who's telling the story. Yes, indeed. And inasmuch as this is still the holiday season, I'm going to tell you how Brutus Barber came to our house on Christmas when I was a boy. He came every year of his life until they laid the old gentleman to rest in the moss-grown cemetery back in West Glory, Iowa, at the decayed old age of 91, in the year 1887. Fanny, why are you looking at me like that?
Because I don't believe there ever was such a person as Brutus Barber.
Me?
Well, it's mighty funny to me. I never heard of him, if there was.
Yes, my dear woman. there are many secret niches in my life which you will discover if you are fortunate enough to live that long.
But go on with Judith Barber, Father Barber. She sounds like a wonderful old man.
You see, Penny, I hold the interest of anyone else. Old Uncle Brutus was a bachelor. A bachelor, a cantankerous old grouch, with sore teeth which he bought from a roadside peddler and which clicked and galloped like a pair of dice when he masticated his victuals. He had the hearing of a titmouse, but he pretended to be stone deaf just so that he could overhear conversations that he had no business overhearing. He lived by himself and pretended to despise the whole family. He'd have nothing to do with any of his relatives all year. Wouldn't receive one of them in his house and refused to set foot in theirs, except on Christmas. And then, bag and baggage and with boxes and bundles, he would descend on our house like a swarm of locusts.
Father, without an invitation?
Invitation? He didn't know the meaning of the word.
I say, I'd have been inclined to tell the old boy all.
Both my father and mother tried it on a number of occasions.
He wouldn't take the hint.
Stone deaf, he couldn't hear a thing. But later, my mother would be talking quietly to Father about the shortage of money. And the next thing we knew, Uncle Brutus had spread our financial condition over the whole neighborhood.
Why, the old sinner.
Now, Fanny, do you say there was no such person?
Yes, I remember Grandmother Barber telling about such a person. However, I didn't remember his name being Brutus.
Brutus Barber.
Well, anyway, you say he brought presents along with him when he came.
Let me tell you about those presents. That's the best index of his character I can give you. Presents and the Christmas tree. He would always manage to arrive at our house before we could get our tree up and decorate it. Having arrived, he would take over the whole project. Until Uncle Brutus died in his 91st year, never did I put a string of popcorn or a popcorn ball or a candle on a Christmas tree and have it stay there.
Uncle Brutus changed everything.
Every last thing that went on that tree. As fast as we'd have the tree to our liking, Uncle Brutus would sneak in and do it over to his liking. And inasmuch as his bulldog determination outlasted ours, the tree always ended up as he wanted it.
Goodness, couldn't you get him out of the house anyway?
I suppose force could have been used, but Father would say, well, he's an old man. He can't possibly last another year. This will be the last time. My father said that at least 10 years I know of. Before Uncle Brutus finally reached 91 and his Waterloo in the form of a mule.
Father, did you say mule?
I did. A mule just as stubborn as Uncle Brutus. The mule kicked at Uncle Brutus and Uncle Brutus kicked back. Yeah. It's a fact. You can read about it in the back files of the West Glory, Iowa Journal. Duel to the death. Uncle Brutus and the mule kicked it out. And Uncle Brutus was getting much the better of it until the mule landed a chance blow full in Uncle Brutus's face and knocked his sore teeth down his throat. There were always two schools of thought. One group, a very small group, believed that it was the blow that killed Uncle Brutus. The majority, however, contended that he was too hard-bitten to be fazed by the kick of a mule, and that it was the false teeth caught in his esophagus that actually did the dirty work.
Henry, don't be so gruesome.
Facts, Fanny, I'm giving you historical data.
Well, you don't have to wallow in it.
But the Christmas presents, Father Barber, you said there was something about them.
Yes, I'm ahead of my story. Well, back in those days, we hung our presents on the tree without wrapping.
No Christmas wrapping paper at all.
Well, we'd never heard of such a thing. Well, sir, it wasn't enough that Uncle Brutus must arrange the decorations. He must shove all other presents to the back of the tree and display his prominently in the foreground.
Dear Brutus.
And such presents. I remember once, he gave your grandmother Barbara an old kitchen stool that had been in the family for years and had finally been discarded to the woodshed.
Father, you're exaggerating.
Nothing of the kind. He rescued it, nailed it together, did it with whitewash, and put it under the tree for my mother.
Oh, penurious, what?
He never bought a present in his life. Oh, he'd sometimes whittle something out of a piece of wood for the children, but mostly the gift was blatantly and obviously off some junk pile.
And he wasn't ashamed.
Ashamed? Why, no other person's presents amounted to a snap of the fingers. He wouldn't even look at what people had given him. No, But he'd praise his own gifts up to the skies.
If all you're saying is true, Henry, I don't see how your mother and father stood it.
Why, yes. I should have thought it would have ruined the whole Christmas season.
Yes, yes. So that's the kind of ancestors the present family of Barbara sprang from, huh?
Yeah. It's a wonder we're such nice people.
Well, just don't forget that you're half my side of the family, and I assure you the Martins were very dignified and proper ancestors.
And just for that, I'm going to have another piece of cold pumpkin pie. I think that... Hey, Betty, look at your plate. You haven't eaten a thing.
I'm sorry.
What in the world, Betty? Are you ill?
Oh, Mother Barbara, I'm dreadfully sick to my stomach.
Why, child, here, come with me.
Here, I'll help you with her, Ma.
But, darling, why did you just sit there? Why didn't you say something?
I don't know.
You want me?
I don't care whether I have you or not.
Well, now then, come along with Mom and me, Betty.
Yes, and you stay there, Jack.
I'm so sick to my stomach.
Oh, you poor kid. Why didn't you say something?
I don't get it. Ever since the war started, she's been sick to her stomach. Any little excitement.
She looks so white.
Just sitting here like that, not saying a word. Well, I guess I'm just married to a girl with a nervous stomach.
Yes, and she's married to one of the dumbest husbands in captivity.
Okay, so I'm dumb. What? Hey, you mean, why doesn't anyone tell me these things?
Just as inevitable as Christmas or New Year's is that day between the two when we wonder if we couldn't exchange some of those less welcome presents. Well, this year, Jack has a scheme to avoid it.
Who knows? This might become a great institution. Jack Barber's Swap Shop, or what size slippers do you wear?
No standing in line.
Satisfaction guaranteed.
Okay, Jack, just how's this fraud of yours going to work?
Oh, perfectly legitimate, Hazel. A boon to mankind. Now, you received a beautiful brown handbag for Christmas. What you really needed was a black one, right?
That's right.
And Cliff got a purple plush smoking jacket.
And what I really needed was a windbreaker.
This gets a little complicated. I don't suppose you two would care to swap, even Stephen.
What in the name of goodness would I do with a purple plush smoking jacket?
Why, it's just the thing for these chilly mornings when you pop out on the porch to bring in the morning paper.
Oh, no, thank you.
And I suppose I should carry Hazel's handbag with me when I go to milk the cows.
That's a beautiful handbag, Cliff. It'll hold a lot of oats.
Oh, Jack, oats for cows?
Well, anyway, it's a big handbag.
Doesn't look as if your scheme is going to work out, son.
Well, I'm not going to give up yet, Mom. You see, for hard-to-please customers like Hazel and Cliff, I'll have a stock of improved tenderleaf tea balls.
Now you're talking.
That's more like it.
Simple, isn't it? Hazel gives me her handbag, and Cliff gives me his plush smoking jacket, and I give both of them tenderleaf tea balls, made of tasteless filter paper. Largest selling tea balls in America.
Well, I'm going to need plenty of tenderleaf tea balls for New Year's. Will you take a pair of gloves that are too large for me?
Why, certainly, Mom.
How about candlesticks and guest towels?
Oh, Jack takes anything.
And by the way, Jack, what are you going to do with all the things you get?
Oh, take them downtown, see if I can swap them for more tenderleaf tea balls. Step up, folks. Bring on your white elephants, misfits, duplicates, and other horrors to Jack Barber's Swap Shop. And take away something everybody wants. Improved tenderleaf tea balls. Step right up, folks. Hurry, hurry, hurry.
Well, here's hoping no one has to exchange any presents. But surely your holiday entertaining will call for Tenderleaf Tea Balls, the largest-selling tea balls in America. So through the New Year's season, whenever friends drop in, and for the family, too, be sure you have plenty on hand. Yes, Tenderleaf Tea Balls have become America's favorite. Made of tasteless filter paper, there's never a speck in your Tenderleaf tea. No foreign taste, but just the delicious flavor of the tiny top tea leaves. Ask your grocer for Tenderleaf brand tea balls or Tenderleaf tea in packages, half-pound or quarter-pound sizes. Either way, it's America's choice for flavor. You've just heard the 13th and final chapter of Book 40 of One Man's Family, written by Carlton E. Morse for the makers of Tenderleaf tea. The opening chapter of Book 41, entitled Jack Grooms Himself for the New Life, will come to you next Sunday at this same hour. One Man's Family comes to you through the courtesy of the makers of Tenderleaf Tea.
Fleischmann's Fresh Yeast is not only one of the richest natural sources of vitamin B complex, it's the only yeast with added amounts of both vitamins A and D. If you bake at home, its vitamins A, B1, D, and G are not appreciably lost in the oven. They go right into the bread. This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.